clean contact.
I'd hit it again, because that shot was a defining moment. And when a defining moment comes along, you define the moment, or the moment defines you.
Well, here it comes. Oh my goodness.
Hello and welcome to the Golf Practice Podcast. My name is Andy Hayes, and with me talking about the USGA distance report, long driving in golf, is Peter Donahue and Steve Schreck. Guys, what's the longest drive you've ever hit?
You know, I drove the ball onto the 18th green at Half Moon Bay, which was hard and downhill and behind downwind, 425 yards.
Wow.
Yeah. This was back in the 70s. Yeah. I mean, ridiculous. I mean, I could really only hit the ball. Farthest I ever hit the ball was, I once might have rolled it up onto the edge of a 300-yard, you know, green in the middle of summer, but that was about it.
Yeah. Steve?
Mine was, it's really funny, actually. I think it was back in, like, seventh grade. I did, like, 380 yards. But it was because I was playing golf with my family in northern Michigan at this course called Elmbrook. And, I mean, it was so dry, the course. I mean, if you lit a match, the thing would have set on fire. But it was this downhill par 4, the 17th hole. I drove it greenside, and I probably carried it about 200 yards.
Yeah.
And it just rolled and rolled and rolled and rolled. And I remember we were like, we were looking for the ball for like 10 minutes because we thought it was way back in the fairway. And I don't really know how we got up towards the green, but maybe we just said, oh, we lost it. And everybody kind of went on with their shots. And I think we wound up finding it up there. So that was pretty fun.
Yeah, you know, when I was a little kid back in the 50s, in the 60s, you know, I was born in 49, the golf courses didn't have watering systems like they do now. And, you know, when they first started putting watering systems in and quick coupling systems, and there was a guy in an old jalopy that would go around at night putting these sprinklers in the thing. But, you know, the first hole at our golf course growing up was 570 yards, and it wasn't anything, you know, in the 50s, for people to roll that ball on the green in two shots in the middle of summer. So, you know, when golf courses started getting watered, they got longer.
This past week on Tuesday, the USGA and RNA, it's the Royal and Ancient from Scotland, they released key findings from their multi-year Distance Insights project. I didn't know this project was going on, but apparently it was. They released a very comprehensive thing of 56 documents and thousands of pages for people who want to really find out a lot about, you know, their report and their research and their findings. We're not going to go into all that. We're going to kind of go have a more surface level look at some of their findings, talk about what it kind of means and where we'll go from here. So basically, this report concluded, perhaps not, you know, the most groundbreaking thing we've ever heard, is that golfers are hitting the ball further than ever. Before 1900, so this is a long time ago, the best golfers' tee shots generally traveled from between 160 to 200 yards. From 1900 to 1930, they created a new ball that had a rubber core that allowed golfers to hit the ball between 220 and 260 yards. For the next 60 years, from 1930 to 1990s, distance grew kind of incrementally. By 1995, the longest 20 players in the PGA Tour averaged 278 yards off the tee, with the tour average being 263. From the mid-90s to 2003, there were new innovations in clubs, the Pro V1 golf ball, the Nike golf ball Tiger Woods started using, had a bit of a spike in the distance, with the average being 286 yards. and the longest players hitting at 300 yards. And then from 2003 to today, the 20 longest players on the PGA Tour averaged 310 yards. So there, people are hitting it farther. What do you guys think about that?
Well, so far, yes, they're hitting it farther, and there's no doubt that the technology of the woods or the metals, when it changed, and that all of a sudden it was the club that was going out of shape and springing back, and the ball got so much better. I mean, that was a huge difference, and it was a great boon for old guys like I am now. You know that you could hit the ball and play the course that you'd gotten used to playing. I think that's what guys in my father's generation certainly measured themselves by. They didn't really want to move forward. They wanted to measure themselves, even if it was the clubs that were doing it. They wanted to see themselves still having the same power that they did when they were younger. And so for a lot of the population, you know, it was a good thing.
Do you remember your first like big driver?
You mean my first metal driver?
Well, sure. Well, first they went from wood to metal,
yeah.
But then didn't they get big?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I really didn't think I'd be able to swing one, you know, that was that big, you know, because it looked so ungainly. It looked like a toaster on the end of a stick, you know, and it really was. But, you know, it's amazing how fast you'll get to like something when it sails off down the middle of the fairway.
Steve?
Well, I guess there's quite a few thoughts on this from my end, but when I was doing research for our article in the newsletter, I was just stunned, and I know I've told you guys this a few times, just some of the numbers as far as the averages. Specifically going back to, like, so they compared it, like, 2003 to 2019, and, like, I was just stunned looking at the numbers. Like, the average driving distance for the Korn Ferry Tour, I don't remember what it was called back then in 2003, but it was, like, it was 292 yards was the average driving distance. You know, fast forward to today, and it's like 302, so 10-yard increase. But even looking back, like, some 17 years, like, I just couldn't believe how that number, you know, because when I think of, like, back in that time, I think of, like, Tiger in the early 2000s, and he must have been hitting it, like, 300, right, I would think. But those guys on that Korn Ferry Tour, they're averaging, like, 290.
Yeah.
So I don't know. That when I was doing the research for this article, that really stood out to me, and just the difference in the driving, you know, averages, you know, according to the tour that they're on. Like, I know, Pete, I was talking with you about this. Like, the European Tour, like, their driving numbers are a little bit longer than the PGA Tour, and you had mentioned, like, yeah, probably because the courses are a little bit faster overseas and probably a little bit wetter here. That's just kind of the difference in how the game's played between here and overseas. But yeah, it was interesting doing the research, and I think you know, some of those numbers were really kind of staggering.
Yeah, I like this report. I think I'm a little frustrated by it. Doesn't really come to conclusions. It says they're going to do another year or so of research before they kind of just say something about this. So we'll go through the rest of the report quickly and then talk about, you know, our conclusions that we drew from it.
Can I just add one quick thing?
Absolutely.
Because they basically said back in, like, 2003-ish, they basically said this exact same thing, the USGA and the RNA, that they were, like, concerned about how far everybody was hitting it. And because I was reading this Golf Channel article where, like, they ended with, like, okay, so they expressed similar concern, you know, nearly two decades ago. Why have they not really done anything? Why are they addressing pretty much the same thing, like, 20 years later?
Well, I think there's, you know, you wonder about it. It is curious, but I think the time is different. I mean, back then, you know, there was the USGA is different. I'm not sure, you know, what to explain it, but I'm sure that there are new people there now. But they were getting criticized back then for really not you know, being a very conservative and staid body, and now you see they've come out and their last rule changes were amazing, you know, for making the game more accessible, relaxing a lot of the stringent rules, and a lot of things that many people thought were silly, you know, and not be, and so they're seem to be much less uptight now. I think that they were concerned about restraint of trade and how that was going to, you know, what was going to happen if they tried to move. Were they going to just be buried in lawsuits and, you know, from manufacturers saying, hey, what are you doing to us? You're killing us. And I think they still are. But I think now, for whatever reason, they've got more will.
Yeah, and I think over time, a big thing to talk about is how the report concludes. This is probably like the biggest conclusion they make, is that this is bad, that hitting it farther is bad for the future of golf, that there's so many courses that they can't hold tournaments at anymore because they're too short. There's not space. I think Marion is a big example that people bring up. They used to have U.S. Opens there, but it's just too short to go back there. Augusta National, this past year, they bought a road so they could take the road out and add another tee box on one of the holes. And so if, like, these like classic courses are being changed. So even St. Andrews, the road hole, when you go there now, there's, I guess it's, is it 17?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's 17. They have a tee box that goes like, it's a different road, not the road, but there's a tee box on the opposite side of the road that seems really out of place. It's basically like on the driving range that they had to add to make the hole, you know, one of the most iconic holes ever in golf, you know, playable for, you know, the British Open competition.
So here's this thing back in 2002 that I was referring to. In this article, it says they had something called Joint Statement of Principles. It was published in 2002 between the RNA and the USGA, and it said they warned, quote, further significant increases in hitting distances at the highest level are undesirable, and will have have the impact of seriously reducing the challenge of the game. And this was 18 years ago that they're saying this, and now they're just like getting to it. That was kind of my point. It's like it's just kind of a little bit interesting to me.
Well, you know, I think that it's better late than never. You know, I mean, Jack Nicklaus was very early talking about this with the Cayman ball and the idea of, you know, being able to have a golf challenge on a much smaller piece of property. But because, you know, the game has grown the balls have, driving distances has gotten longer as technology changed, that's part of the fabric of the game and part of its history. And especially living in a capitalist world where you're driven by the market. And I think they've gotten to the point where now they've said, you know, and it's sort of like climate change, you know, like, hey, we know that change is inevitable, but is there some part of this that, you know, is really going to be detrimental that we ought to take specific action to do something about, mitigate it in some way? And, you know, what they're talking about in terms, what are the options? The options are simply to build longer and longer golf courses, which, you know, does make the game slower unless we're all going to zip around in motorized vehicles. And it's going with more ground to have to maintain. Costs are going to go up unless we figure out how to have more waste areas and actually reduce the amount of water. And that's what I think the USGA has done, is they've thrown this out there now and they've said, listen, we've done a lot of research, and we're welcome for diverging opinions to come forward now, and let's actually have a discussion about this thing and about things like bifurcation. You know, should we have a separate set of rules for the tour players as we do, you know, for, and they're saying, oh no, we don't want to do that, because why? Well, because we never have done it, you know, and we pride ourselves on the fact that, you know, that these golfers can play the same golf course as the tour players, but what? I met some guys when we played Augusta that, Dan Marino and Peyton Manning were down there at the same time. And when we saw them They were playing one nine, we were playing the other, so we crossed at the turn, and they were playing the tournament tees at Augusta. And Dan said that he had shot 45, you know, on the back nine. I asked him, you know, what's your game normally like? He said, I shot 77 from the member tees yesterday. So, you know, a 7 or 8 shot difference. Now, is that the kind of, is that what you want to do? You want to go to a golf course and play the same course that the tour players are playing and shoot 100? You know, well, I mean, if that's your pleasure, that's not my pleasure. But I do see, you know, I do see that some people, you know, like that. Would it be different if we were playing with different equipment? You know, if the tour players were playing with, you know, a standard ball, not the Slazenger or the whatever the latest, you know, hot ball is. That's not too hot, probably.
I was going to say
that's the Dunlop.
Slazenger, that's the ball my dad used to play back in the day. I love that reference.
It's called the ChromeSoft X with triple track technology.
There we go. That's why I love being around you guys. I mean, you prop me up when I fall down.
Yeah, the frustrating thing about that this is coming out now is it's hard to see them kind of going backwards. In the report, it's clear that like they don't want to go, you know, they're not going back to Persimmon Woods or something. I don't think they would roll back the equipment or the ball. Like, I mean, 10%, like the tour players would be hitting it, there'd be 30 yards less. It just seems weird. I don't see that actually happening.
Well, you know, I don't think, I do see it happening, because I don't think that people, when they're watching golf on television, there's no sense of, you know, you see the swing, you see somebody stick a camera tracking a ball in the sky, you have no idea where it's going to come down, you do see it come down, but there's no, it's not like being there and being awestruck by the power of these guys. If this is a TV sport, right, then rolling them back is perfectly fine. And if you look at, you know, some people say, well, you know, you're penalizing, you know, big hitters and stuff like that. I don't see that. How is that the case? Or how would that be the case? I would think that the technology could make everybody proportionately shorter. Long guys would and gals would still be longer. But when you look at, you know, when you watch television and you're seeing these guys play, I mean, how often do you see their balls end up like 10 yards apart in the same place? These guys are really good, and the equipment has gotten to the point right now where, you know, they it's not that they never hit it offline, but it ain't like it used to be.
How did it used to be?
The ball would spin sideways, you know, and not be as straight. So I don't see if this is mainly a made-for-TV sport, you know, as far as the pros and how they're hitting it, I just don't see why. And you can stop now. You know, like, that's okay. We're not, you know, we're not rolling anything back, but we're not going forward either. You know, and because, honestly, when you go to, you know, they just played at Pebble Beach, right? In 1972, one of the most dramatic shots in the history of the game was Jack Nicklaus hit a one iron at the 17th hole into the wind, and he hit it, and he hit the flag, and he had a kick in for a birdie. Now, that was one of the greatest golf shots ever, and it was a heroic shot because he was hitting a one iron. And nowadays, to cover that same distance, these guys are, what are they hitting? You tell me.
How long? 200 yards? Yeah.
Seven iron.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So that, is that a heroic shot? Are you really impressed when a guy stakes a seven iron? I'm not.
No.
And I'm you know, you loaned me this book about St. Andrews, about Pepper or Peeper. Yeah. George going over there and living there for 2 years, and he's talking about studying the golf course and he spoke about the fact that the 12th hole was Jack Nicklaus's favorite hole on the golf course. Now, the 12th hole is only 310 or 14 yards, but there was a scattering of these pot bunkers across the fairway, and Nicklaus would, you know, have to choose an iron and to try to play in a strategic place, you know, to get away from these bunkers. And now they're not even concerned with those bunkers. I mean, this is a drivable par four, and there's nothing to threaten them. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, you've really taken the skill, you know, out of the course. And when these, you know, classic golf course, St. Andrews, I mean, everybody who says they played there more than just once, you know, says, gosh, the more you play it, the more you appreciate its design, its subtleties, and its wonderfulness. And so we're taking that out of the game now. Yeah. Pine Valley, the 18th hole at Pine Valley, when Gene Littler and Byron Nelson played their match there in Shell's Wonderful World of Golf back in 1962 or whatever it was, those guys were both hitting woods to the 18th green, and you must carry that wood over a pond, over a steep face hill with bunkers all over it to the green. Now the green is huge; it's an absolutely enormous bowl, and it's designed to receive a wood shot. Well, now you've got people that just knock it to the end of the fairway, and they're hitting pitching wedge in there. Are you going to say, wow, that was a great experience I just had playing Pine Valley? Oh, it's not so hard. All you have to do is hit the ball in the, you know, fairway and then hit your wedge on the green. Well, come on. That's not a gratifying experience to a golfer who's a sportsman.
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, I agree. I'm kind of on the similar thinking. It's just like golf is such a historic game where, like, the St. Andrews and the Pine Valleys and, like, all the courses that Pete's referring to, like, it's very important, I think, that those are able to be played now in, like, 100 years down the line, in my opinion. So, like, when these driving distances and just distance in general with your clubs are increasing and the ball is going further, like Pete said, like just the original intentions of that golf course, the original layout, how those designers wanted that course to be played, that's no longer. So I just don't feel like that's right. And like a lot of times, I know we've done it, like they've done it with US Opens and stuff, where they just keep moving the tees back on certain courses. You know, I guess that works sometimes on some holes, but on a lot of holes, like even if you do move the tees back like 30 yards, and maybe those bunkers are still like in your mind as far as, you know, can you carry them or not? Like the sight lines change, like just everything about it changes. It's not always so simple as just adding like 40 yards, you know, moving the tee box 40 yards. I just don't think that's right, in my opinion. So, I think, I mean, obviously something looks like it's going to be done here in the next couple of years, but I think just maintaining some of those courses and like just the history of golf is pretty important.
Yeah, I mean, I loved Royal Melbourne during the President's Cup because the way that course was set up, it was so firm and fast, driving wasn't that big of an advantage because it was all about what angle you're coming into. Like if you hit it the farthest, the green's too firm. So if you're coming in at the wrong angle, you don't have a chance to get it close. So you're deciding, should I go up the left side, should I go up the right side of the fairway? And too many American courses, or at least the ones you see on TV, it's like, I think Torrey Pines is a good example of it. It's just like, here's a hole that's 500 yards with a slight dog leg to the right, and there's two bunkers, just hit it as straight and as far as you can, and whoever's able to do that week is, you know, the champion. It would be cool if we, you know, these courses that, like, Alistair McKenzie designed, you know, in what they call the golden age of architecture of, like, the 20s and 30s, like Royal Melbourne, like Augusta, that influence, or that where your strategy and shot making is more rewarded, if we kind of went away from that, and it's become long and narrow and not about strategy, just about how far and straight you can hit it. So I think there's that architecture aspect of this as well, where players are just doing kind of what the course is asking them to do.
That's an interesting point. Yeah, you're right. You know, I think we live in a time right now where you see the trend towards less water, more brown, mm-hmm. you know, is starting to take a root. You know, American sensibilities, I remember being talking to an old-timer, my father and I, in the clubhouse after years ago. We played at Royal County Down in Northern Ireland, and he said, "You Yanks," he said, "you've ruined our game. You've ruined our courses with all your water and your fertilizer." Yeah. He said, "It used to be that from 150 yards out on the first hole, a golfer might choose his putter."
Yeah.
Can you imagine seeing a ball roll over this humpy, hilly ground up and down, disappear from your sight, then reappear again and come up? You know, I mean, that really was, you know, an entertaining game if you think about the kinds of things that interest human beings. I mean, you know, if we go to the carnival and we see what it is that we like to see moving balls hopping around and rolling, and we like to see launching. And so, you know, the launching part of us has kind of hijacked the game. It's not that it isn't interesting, but, you know, to me, The Pumpkin Chunkin' Festival down in Peoria, Illinois, you know, down in that neighborhood, you know, used to be all these homemade catapults and these funny contraptions that people would make to hurl these pumpkins. And it was, you know, it was fun just to see what people would come up with. Well, now they're just coming out there with cannons. They're just firing pumpkins out of cannons. Now, you know, is that fun? Yeah, I think we enjoy seeing missiles sail high and far into the air, but, you know, there's a charm that's not there anymore.
Hold on. A pumpkin chunkin' festival?
Chunkin'.
Pumpkin chunkin' festival.
Yeah. Pumpkin chunkin'. I think, you know, maybe it was part of the fall festival. I'm not sure what it was called, but I remember seeing it. It's pumpkin chunking down in
How
Central
often do you
Illinois.
Go to this?
Oh, it's a fall sport.
So you go every fall to Peoria? I didn't know this about
yeah.
you. This is a good. Most of the, you know, podcasts or articles I've read and listened to about this, they talk about how technology has had such played such a big part into this growing distance. And Steve, I'm glad you're here, because what you're saying about like 10 yards has been gained over the last, what, 15 years, 16 years?
Yeah.
To me, that number actually seems kind of small.
Like, it does, yeah.
10 yards, that actually makes sense to me with TrackMan launch monitors. Yeah. People are now I feel like more athletes are playing golf. And you think about just writing down names of who I remembered, like Tiger Woods' major wins, like who he used to kind of come up against. And it was like Bob Tway and Rich Beam and David Duval and Rocco Media. And I mean, no offense to those guys, but they're not, you know, they're no Brooks and Rory and Dustin Johnson, Ricky Fowler. Like, it just seems like more athletic people are playing golf, and they figured out, hey, if you hit up on the ball, this thing's going to go farther. And I wonder how you balance that with, you know how you keep distance down while balancing just this desire of just like, we're getting better at the sport and humans are figuring out how to do it better. Like, the similar things happening in the NBA where teams have figured out that three-pointers are just way more valuable than like a long two-pointer. So like the best teams shoot a ton of three-pointers and a ton of layups, and they don't want kind of any of the mid-range anymore. And it's really changed how the sport is played and what players are good and what players are bad. Like, a post-up center isn't in the league anymore because he can't stay on the floor. So is that something where it's like, well, basketball's always been played with a post-up game, we need to find a way to keep the post-up game? Or it seems they're saying, no, that we've just figured out a way to do this better. How do you think we balance, though? Because you know, this idea of like we're doing something, we're going too far, or it's going too far, seems like, well, what if they just figured out that, hey, hitting it far is the best way to play golf? Like, it's the most efficient, and the numbers and stats would back it up. How do you balance that with keeping this integrity or the game, the way the game's always been played?
Well, I don't, you know, the way the game's always been played, that's interesting because, you know, Bobby Jones, you know, made the famous statement after seeing Jack Nicklaus, this guy is playing a game with which I'm not familiar, you know, and I'm not sure that was entirely true, but Nicklaus was hitting the ball farther than and higher, you know, than players in Jones's generation. I think that I think you have to look at things and say, you know, the proof is in the pudding. You know, how interesting is the game? You know, I think that baseball, you know, Babe Ruth, they say saved baseball. You know, Babe Ruth was the long ball era, and Ty Cobb, you know, who came before him, was this, you know, slapping the ball around the infield, hitting runs and making contact and skillful, you know, batting where you could hit to all fields and that kind of thing, and the base stealing. You see these guys in baseball now. These guys, none of them know how to slide. I mean, every time you see a guy slide, you think, oh, God, it was a miracle he didn't break his ankle. You know, they're not skillful in sliding. You know, they're all head first now, and they all, because of sabermetrics, they're waiting, you know, for the three-run homer. Well, I mean, there is a there was a tension and excitement in the air back in, you know, I remember watching the my favorite team, the Milwaukee Braves, playing against the Los Angeles Dodgers in 1959 playoffs, where the Dodgers eventually won and played the White Sox the last time the White Sox went to the World Series. No, not the last time. The time before, 2005. When Maury Wills got on base, man, the whole place was on the edge of their seats waiting to see what would happen. Because, you know, when guys moved on the bases, the ball was being thrown. There was chances for errors and overthrows and more bases. And, you know, it was terribly exciting. I think way more exciting than waiting for a guy to jerk a three-run homer. But, you know, where's the success come from? You know, and the shifts in baseball right now, is that fun? See some guy hammer a ball and see a guy play short right field, pick it up and throw him out. I mean, what's going to be fun is when hitters, and I don't know whether they're going to find their way to this solution, actually make them stop doing that by hitting the other way. Right now, yeah, it's just, oh, no, the three-run homer is the way we're going to combat that. So it's just strikeouts, home runs, and line drives hit into shifts. I don't think it's that cool a game anymore.
No.
And I think golf suffers the same thing. I mean, really, when you're hitting drives and wedges, I mean, is that that's a cool game? I mean, and now I realize they're covering distance, and you can say, well, you know, I mean, it's a hell of a skill to cover the distance. I don't care what you're doing. A guy that can hit any shot 190 yards and hit it next to the hole, that's an amazing thing. Well, yeah, it's really, I mean, there's a reason that diamonds are more precious than pebbles on a beach. You know, I mean, it's not that big a deal if it's not rare.
Yeah, I mean, I think the comparison to the center that you brought up, Andy, in basketball, I think that's an interesting point because it's like, the game is changing quite a bit, or has already changed here in the last decade or so to a mostly 3-point game. And the centers have been, I mean, I remember Purdue had like a 7'2" center. I went to Purdue, and so I follow the basketball program pretty closely. They had a 7'2" center a few years ago, was a really good player. And if you were to stick him in like the 1980s, like he probably would have been a first round pick, right? But now since he's playing in today's game, he went undrafted, and now he's playing in the G League. So the game has changed, and I think a lot of people probably don't like it. You know, some people do, and I guess that comparison does make sense to golf. I don't really have the answers for that. I mean, it's, I think you got to strike a balance because, like, it's a little bit more, like, you're thinking building golf courses, like, we can't, in a lot of situations, like, you can't build them any longer.
Right.
Like, in some situations, like, adding 40 yards to a tee box, like, there's tons and tons of golf courses in the world where that's just not feasible. So, I think you just need to strike a balance. I mean, I don't think there's anything. I like seeing the long drives, but there has to be some sort of rule in place, in my opinion. I would make two rules. I would make the balls and the equipment have some sort of standard rule on tour. I guess they already kind of do right now, but I would focus in on that and try to keep it a standard thing on tour, and then the amateur golf I wouldn't worry so much about right now. Now that might change in the future, but I think there should be two sets of rules. I know Pete, like, obviously they've had, it's just one set for since the beginning of the game, but I think moving forward it might be good to have two sets.
I think just because we've never done it is not no longer a good reason to continue. We were talking earlier, golfers used to, pride themselves on the fact that their sport was, when I was growing up, the only sport where the athletes really have to earn their way. And that was true back when Hogan and Snead and those guys were playing. They didn't get appearance money. Well, that was a big source of pride among, real golf purists, and our guys don't get appearance money like tennis and these other sports. Well, those days are long gone. The inducements for these people to show up and the hunger for them to need to win in order to make money, it just isn't, it's not there. It's in my generation, though, guys, it was still, you had to be successful, out on tour, earning your way to get over that nut that you cost you every year to be out there. But, the financial part of it is the least interesting part of it to me, so I never study that. But that would be an interesting study, like how many guys that are on the tour. I suppose that was part of their new design, was that everybody who had made the tour was going to make money, was going to have a decent life. I don't know if that's true or not. But
I mean, a bunch of those guys went over to Saudi Arabia to play for a ton of appearance money, so it happens a lot. It's a lot.
Yeah.
I like that. I don't know if I would like that there, if there are separate rules or separate equipment. One of the things I like about golf is I feel like once in a while I can hit a shot that, or anyone, one of our kids could hit a shot that Tiger Woods would be just as happy about that shot. And for me, something about if he was using a different ball or different clubs, wouldn't quite have the same feeling for me. So I think if there were different rules for the tour, I would just, I could buy that ball myself and play it. But I feel like, I wonder if other people would, I guess maybe from hearing from you guys, maybe they don't care quite so much. Because it seems, there seem to be pretty clear in the report that they don't want to do separate rules for the tour and for amateurs.
I think you're right. I mean, that's they feel funny about it, like you do.
Yeah, that they want to play under a single set of rules, that it's a strength and virtue of the game, and they're steadfast in retaining that. That's what Mike Davis said. What if they, like you were saying, Pete, when Jack Nicklaus, when they used to miss a drive, the ball would spin and it would go way more offline. What if the solution somehow along the lines of the ball can't get any further and then the driver, it just has to get smaller? So the guys who can still hit it far, they'll still be able to hit it far, but that sweet spot's not going to be as big as it is on the drivers that we have today. So hitting it far or even swinging fast would bring more risk into the shot. When we had Nick Kiefer, that long drive guy who's been around here, talks about people always ask him, like, why can't those long drive guys hit the grid more often? Because they have like 10 balls and they hit like 1 out of 10 actually like finds the fairway in their competition. He's like, well, they're swinging so fast that like the slightest degree off kind of misses it. And so what if we almost take that idea and build it into our own clubs, where like the guys who are swinging 125 miles an hour, like it, the sweet spot's not as big as it is today, so that their misses are going to be much more offline, which would make them think twice about hitting it again. I mean, Brooks Koepka in the Bethpage last year, where he did he win? Yeah, he won, right? Yeah, he beat Dustin Johnson, right? Yes, he in the PGA Championship. He had, it was long, rough, long course. He just smoked driver down every single hole. It didn't even think about where it was going. Whereas if someone like him who's trying to hit it 350 yards, if there's more like risk reward in that, I think it makes it more interesting. And then also it doesn't damage the amateurs quite as much, doesn't damage us quite as much, because we can't swing it 130 miles an hour. So our misses won't be penalized as greatly as theirs.
So are you saying that the amateurs would be playing the same clubs as them?
Is that I guess you'd have the... I'm mostly focusing on the driver. So if you wanted to keep your 460cc driver, I suppose you could do that. But like it's like on tour, the max is, what, 250? Maybe our three-wood size. I don't know.
I like that idea. Yeah, penalizing the misses more. As long as... Because it is important to like focus on the amateurs in this thing too. Like... We're like, they're all about growing the game, right? And like, we want people to be having fun. And like, so if you're reducing the size of the face of the club and making miss hits, making the penalty for miss hits more substantial, like, what about the person who's just starting off and just spraying their driver like 60 yards right every time? Like, that's not going to be fun for them. So, like, just striking a balance between those two is important.
I think, yeah, I don't know that. That the idea of playing, as you were saying, you could hit the same shot as Tiger Woods. I think it's the shot is measurable by, you know, where it ends up in relation to the hole. You know, the skills of the game are, you know, really approaching the greens, and being able to approach the greens from favorable angles, like you were talking earlier about the design of golf courses. And you know, so that misses aren't necessarily that they're penalized, but not in the way that a tight tree-lined golf course, you know, would penalize. It would, you know, penalize like, well, you've got a different line of play to this flag, but not like you're not shut out.
Stops. Yeah.
I think, you know, I like that kind of thinking, and you know, I think that it's interesting to play golf with rollback equipment. I mean, you know, wooden shafted clubs are fascinating. I mean, actually, I because it requires, you can feel when you hit it that, oh my, this isn't going to, at least that was my experience last year when I got mine, my whatever it is, 6-iron or 3-iron or 3-iron that looks like a 6-iron. But, you know, when you hit it well, and you hit a good shot with it, it's not as common as it is with
it. It felt like an accomplishment almost.
It did.
Like when you,
it
when
really
you struck
did.
It well.
Yeah,
yeah. And that's fallen out of the game.
Fallen out of the game. Yeah. And I think that it does. I think it makes, you know, all of a sudden, you know, for me, when I was playing with that club around Canal Shores last year, I mean, 130 yard shots were. That was a good shot. You know, he hit it with it, for me anyway, you know. And so so now all of a sudden it takes something that that I wouldn't have considered, you know, back, you know, when I was a younger man, more than a wedge, and it certainly turned it into a real skill challenge.
I mean, I'm all for, if that was an option, I would love golf just as much, or maybe even more than now, if like everyone's going back to, you know, whatever. But I just don't, so I would vote for it, but I don't think other people would.
No, but you know, I think that at any rate, I think the notion that we're all playing one game, we're all playing a game that looks the same because you could describe it in the same way. You know, they're playing with an L-shaped heel-shafted stick. that's going like this, and they're, you know, counting consecutive strokes, and they, yeah, we're all playing the same game, but we're not all playing the same game. I mean, the guys that can hit it, generate 140 miles an hour of club head speed are not playing the same game that you and I are playing. I mean, when you say that, you know, that if you were going to have the same experience that tour players have, and you carry the ball in the air 200 yards, the golf course that you should be playing to have the same experience the tour players are having when they're playing a 7,500-yard golf course is like 5,600 yards.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's a very short golf course. So that you're playing a, you know, a 6,600-yard golf course, and you carry it 200 yards, you're not playing the same game as a tour player. You're hitting woods all over the place, and that's not the same game. So to think that you are is like you're nuts. It's a delusional.
Yeah, that's a good point. I think a lot of golfers are delusional. The good thing about the way it is now is like at all kinds of golf courses, there are a ton of different tees you can play from. So you do have options. So that's good. I think sometimes like players don't really have a great feel for their game, or maybe they think they're a lot better than they are. And so they challenge that. You'll see like a guy playing, he might shoot like high 80s and he's playing from like 6,800. And it's like, you're not supposed to be playing from back there, you know? So I think a lot of players probably should just do their homework as far as like not thinking they're scratch golfers when they're shooting in the 80s, and do a better job of just finding the tees that fit them. And
well, it's just all about people's ego and your ego. Well, I mean, everyone's ego gets in the way at some point, but for some people, for some reason, their ego attaches themselves to what tee box they're playing way more than it should be.
Men and women.
Sure, exactly.
And the club they're hitting versus the result of the shot. Like, I remember just growing up, like, playing with, you know, kids my age. Like, I would be hitting, like, maybe a 8-iron from 150, and, like, I'd hit it maybe 20 feet. And then another guy would hit, like, a pitching wedge, and he'd miss the green, but it'd be, like, greenside. And, like, that was always, like, a source of pride for him, you know, that he pulled, like, a pitching wedge and I hit 8-iron, and yet he was still farther away.
Yeah.
It's just something about golf that's funny.
Yeah, it is very funny. Yeah, when you scull your sand wedge and hit it 190 yards or something, and, like, you're proud of that. Great job.
Well, guys, any last thoughts before we call it a day?
Well, I think that I think it's a great discussion because it has been going on forever. And, you know, it isn't like we haven't lost golf courses to history, you know, that courses have become obsolete. It does seem a shame that what once was a wonderful challenge, and that still could be a wonderful challenge, you know, if it had equipment that would match it and create that challenge for us, isn't there. But I suppose it could be if, you know, if we had the option to go back. Like if you were, you know, you said, yeah, you could actually have this experience if you wanted to, but you'd have to be playing with this ball. This is the old English ball. It was a little smaller, 1.62, you know, in inches and in diameter and all that kind of thing. Well, you know, why not? I mean, they make hickory clubs, you know. If we had an event out on tour where the guys, you know, had to play old equipment, and it was, you know, that was the particular challenge, I mean, why not try that? See if anybody cared, you know, see if the players enjoyed the experience.
I think the players absolutely would care. They would not.
They wouldn't like it.
No, I mean, I've been, they have this like the council of player, you know, I don't know, player advisory committee who they kind of decide what, they help decide what courses tournaments are at and what like the setups are like. And they want it to have a very similar setup week to week to week to week. So you're not having to basically learn a new course or learn a new strategy each time you go to a new place. And I think it's why you see this basically the same thing kind of over and over and over again. There's not a lot of variety. There's not a lot of different things going on in the courses or the setup. It's all, Torrey Pines, when they were playing, you know, there's some of those shots that like go are right by the cliff, you know, or into the green, but they have the rough is so long right next to the green. So shots, you miss the green by a yard. And it's like, if this was at Royal Melbourne, you're getting shot 50 yards away down the hill, but it just stops right there in the rough. So I think the players are very picky about what they like, and
well, that
kind of makes sense. They're good at it, so why would you want to change something when millions and millions of dollars are at stake for you?
A little bit similar to like when they went away with the long putter a few years back. Remember, like all those good players, like Adam Scott, where they're attaching it to their upper mm-hmm. body, and they went away with that, and like some of those guys were really good putters. But only because of that movement and that the way they did things, and then that rule outlawed that, and now a lot of those guys aren't very good putters. So I think, you know, there's going to be disagreement with any rule change. I mean, in anything in golf, that's just how people are. So no, but I'm interested to see kind of what they do and how they move forward. Andy, I know you referenced earlier, like you were surprised at how low that the difference between just the 10 yards in the last 16 years. Uh-huh. I would completely agree. I didn't mean to say, you know, say otherwise. I was just surprised with just the distance in general. Mm-hmm. Like 292 yards in 2003 from the Korn Ferry Tour guys, like that was a startling number to me. And now like 302 yards is the average on that tour. Like that's pretty crazy to me. I would agree that the 10 yard difference isn't large. And then when you look at like the PGA Tour, I mean, it was 285 back in 2003. Now it's 293. And then the European Tour, it was 286 in 2003, and now it's 290, basically 295. So not like crazy jumps, but just, you know, some like just the Korn Ferry Tour jumped out to me to being kind of like I had to like look again. I was like, is that right, or is that a you know, a mistype? So
yeah, I read about when at Kapalua, where they had the Sony Open or something in Hawaii, and they like did a big renovation. I think that's the course they renovated. One of the Hawaii ones they renovated, and the architect put a pot bunker. Corin Crenshaw, they put a pot bunker in the middle of a par four in the middle of a fairway, and because players were only playing the hole a certain way, so they tried to add strategy to it, and they put this pot bunker in the hole, and then they like built it, but the players were like, this pot bunker's too deep, you can't reach the green from the pot bunker. And the architects were like, of course, like that's the whole purpose of it. But obviously the players won that argument, and they like raised, there's still a pot bunker there, but you can hit the green from it easily. So it's like the players are so particular, and they don't want to budge, and they like things their way. So I think our only hope is we need Augusta National to lead the way, because those guys seem to do whatever the hell they want. Yeah. And if they say our tournament's being played with this ball or with these clubs, and if you don't like that, like go somewhere else. Like players are not going to skip the Masters, and then other tournaments just want to be like the Masters, so they will change as well, I think.
I think you've hit the excellent note. I think that is our hope.
Oh, God. Augusta National.
They're the only people that are powerful enough to do it. If the players, if the lunatics are running the asylum, as the saying goes, you know, that's, I can see having them have an advisory role in it, but if they're just making rules up about the game that are convenient for them,
yeah,
that's like saying, well, of course the president had a perfect right to strong arm a foreign country because it was in the best interest of the United States, because anybody running for office feels it's in the national interest that they get elected. I mean, what kind of logic is that?
I mean, you know, I love when this podcast veers into politics as much as any of us. I think that was a great point, but I also think we should probably just wrap up there because we could be here 2 more hours talking about
how long has it been? It feels like it's been about 5.
All right, thank you all for listening, guys. Thanks for being here. We'll talk to you all next time.
Clean contact.
I hit it again because that shot was a defining moment. And when a defining moment comes along, you define the moment, or the moment defines you.